You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta. Thanks for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum. Each week, we interview interesting folks from around Atlanta about the interesting things that they're doing. And today, I have with me Kevin Utz. Kevin is the executive chef owner of the Spotted Trotter Gourmet Charcuterie and the new full-service restaurant, Cock and Trice, in Krog Street Market. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Amanda.
Do you want me to admit what just happened?
I think it would be fun for the audience to know.
We were about 10 or 15 minutes into the interview, and no, it was more like 5 minutes in, but I realized we weren't recording. So hopefully this will all sound very fresh. So you're a chef now, and you're a charcuterie. What do you say a person that does charcuterie?
In France, you would be considered a charcutier.
A charcuterie.
It's very elegant. But yeah, it's someone that makes charcuterie would be considered a charcutier, yes.
And by charcuterie, you don't mean just that plate of meat and cheeses that you get at the restaurant.
I guess the best way to describe it in American culture would be to further process. You know, there's a lot of debate on, well, we're just a butcher shop. Well, you are a butcher shop if you, you know, strictly cut meat. You know, you may do a little smoking. Charcuterie, to me, it really stands out when you're further processing it to a point of making something a little bit more elegant.
So not just processing like bologna from Oscar Mayer. That's right. Not charcuterie, or is it? I mean, technically it is, right?
I think there are bolognas that can be charcuterie, but for the most part, not all butchery can be charcuterie. But most charcuterie can be butchery, in my personal opinion. I don't know that that holds true across the world, but I think, you know, butchery, it holds a very big place for folks that are just cutting meat and doing a little bit of processing. Charcuterie, to me, would come into play with when you're thinking about making pâtés and terrines and developing salumi and...
Salumi?
Salumi.
Is that like salami?
It is. It's the plural, salumi. And in Italy, a salumeria... It typically is a lot of pork. It's mainly pork-based products. So I think each culture has, you know, come into play with what they want to describe and define as being a meat processing facility. And in the United States, butchery would be considered, you know, what it would be in France as a charcuterie.
I honestly did not know. I mean, this is all new to me. Like, I honestly thought that people go to the Spotted Trotter because they want, you know, some meat to cook, but you've already cooked the meat.
Yes.
Or prepared it.
Charcut means cook meat. We have prepared the meat. And when we first opened, we had probably over 65 different cooking preparations and techniques that were going into the different meats that we were buying.
Are there a lot of charcuteries in the U.S.?
There are now. It's becoming more popular, and it's something that's taking shape where the grocery stores went from you could come in at one point in time and talk to your grocer and the butcher behind the counter, and you could get a cut of meat. And then, you know, there's a whole ball of wax I could get into about the way that went over the past 30, 40 years and how we almost lost an entire art form of butchery in the United States. And so... this is more about helping people understand that it is a true art form and that people can go into this business as a whole. And I think celebrating charcuterie is a way to see it at its best. And so that's what we try to do.
All right. So we're going to talk about charcuterie as an art form, but let's talk about how you learned it.
Okay.
You know, what were your early influences in the kitchen?
Well, going all the way back to as a child, I think my mom played a huge part in me becoming a chef. She was an extremely talented cook. She would have these lavish cooking parties where she'd invite her friends over. And we just recently, about a year ago, found some notebooks where we were flipping through and she had complete menus written out with recipe cards of all the French cooking that she would do. And we found those. It was a really neat thing to find. Through that point in time, I was a young child, and when I was a baby even, I would be getting a bath from my mom, and she'd be having these dinner parties, and she would come up and give me a bath, and I can remember smelling her breath and smelling the different things on her breath, the garlic and different breads and cheeses and things. It was really neat. And then as I got older and as a child and would see her cooking and watch her, what she was doing, it all came full circle for me. And then my father, when I was about eight or 9 years old, he built a huge smoking pit in our backyard. My brother and I got to have a part in that by building the brick paver path all the way to the smoker. And it was massive. It was about a 10 by 12 foot box. It had a giant lever on the top, and he would do these, you know, huge cooking events where he would cook big giant butts and stuff. So consistently always being enamored with cooking and having the opportunity to cook myself was something that came into play when my mom started started managing a restaurant and then went into opening and helping manage a restaurant here in Atlanta for about 15 years.
Tell me a little bit about working in your mom's restaurant. It's called Flamingo Joe's.
Yeah. So that was a 50s and 60s diner. She owned it and managed it with one of the neighborhood families. And there was a restaurant that was in East Cobb, and they decided to open another arm of that down in downtown Atlanta. So I was always there, always around. You know, I had a job as a young kid, always prepping food. And it was just something where I could look around and see that this could be something that could culminate into a career for me if need be.
So you were in the kitchen. You weren't just bussing tables. You're actually helping cook.
I think I played a piece in every role in that restaurant, yeah.
But so you didn't decide you wanted to be a chef right away?
No, not at all. Not at all. I didn't go to school till I was about 25. I spent a long period of my life figuring out what I didn't need to be doing.
What were some of the things you didn't need to be doing?
I originally wanted to be in film. That was where my aspirations were, to be a big movie star. And then I realized that I was a diabetic and couldn't get health benefits because the industry is such that you just can't have consistent work. And not consistent work calls for not consistent health care and so on and so forth. So I didn't pursue that. Before college, I worked at UPS as an operations manager for 6 years.
So you went to school, but you still, even at that point, didn't know you wanted to be a chef.
I went to school at UGA, and yeah, I was in telecom, and my mom was always pushing me to get a corporate job. And so while I was in school in Athens, I went and got a job at UPS. My school led me to further my career in telecom, and so then I got a job at Home Depot working in the advertising business. I got let go there during the time when they were fighting tooth and nail with Lowe's and trying to compete. So I saw a lot of corporate culture. And my wife was just consistently saying, "You're not happy. What, you know, what are you doing?" And so my wife and I decided that it was time for me to do what I was really good at. So she gave me that opportunity. I have to say, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you today without her. And she has played a huge role in the man that I am and what I've become.
So wait, how did you get trained to become a chef?
I went to school at Cordon Bleu here in Atlanta. While I was there, I was looking around, and because I started at a much later point in my life, I was looking around, looking at the agriculture and kind of what was happening in the food scene. And, you know, we would get carrots just to work on in class, and they were the size of my arm. And I was like, this isn't normal. Something about this isn't right. Nobody in the classes were asking where the food's coming from, what's happening. So I dug a little deeper and got involved with Slow Food Atlanta with Julie Schaefer. And I made a really big push to try to get a Slow Food Convivia started at the Cordon Bleu. And we did. It was through that I really started to understand what my role was going to be in food and food preparation. And
so what is Slow Food?
Slow Food is good, clean, and fair food. It started in Italy, and the idea is that you're taking foodways and food systems and you're celebrating them to a point where you're allowing the true essence of what the food should be, which is good, clean, and fair, and allowing the folks that have spent their life's work and maybe a second, third, fourth, or fifth generation family grow and continue to put good food on the plates of everybody. And so Carlo Petrini started Slow Food in Italy, and they were going to open a McDonald's. It's close to the Vatican. Carlo Petrini did a sit-in across from this McDonald's. They really made people understand that this isn't the place for that.
Yeah, and so it's kind of a reaction to fast food, this idea of slow food.
Like,
we don't need to be in a hurry and just get things that are fast and cheap.
Right.
But good things are actually healthy for us and healthy for the people that make them.
Exactly. The slow food came across the pond and really tried to release into what was happening into our food system. And I could talk for several hours on the mistakes that we've made and how in the late 70s, Alice Waters really changed the whole system of how we look at food. And it's taken now till 2015 for people to really start, you know, it's a change that takes years, you know, it takes a really long time. So within the elements of school and knowing that I had to have an area of where I wanted to go, like, to me, I wanted to find out who was doing that the most in Atlanta. So I reached out to Elizabeth Moore, who owns a PR company called Green Olive Media, and I met with her, and it was an informational interview. I wasn't trying to get a job. And she said, "Kevin, what you probably need to do is meet this guy who's coming about and really having a social change in his food, and that's Linton Hopkins." And I met Linton and went to go do a stage with him. And
You have to explain what a stage is, because not everybody knows.
A stage is something, unfortunately, it's going by the wayside because of what's happening in our country with regards to labor. And there's a lot of elements of cooking and learning how to cook that have to be done off the clock. unfortunately, if you go work for somebody and they make profit from what you prepare, you have to pay them. There's a lot of people that want a stage, but they make it very difficult now. But
so stage is like a free internship.
It's like a free internship, but you're not really in school. So it's just, you're essentially just going to work for free so that you can learn how, you know, this institution dances and how you dance so they can watch you. And you essentially learn if it's someplace you want to go and work. And they can check you out and you essentially check them out and we find out if it's going to be a good fit for both of you. And so I went to go work for Linton Hopkins and discovered that the way that he thought about food and still currently thinks about food.
And that's at Restaurant Eugene?
Restaurant Eugene, yeah.
That place is fancy.
Yeah, it's pretty fancy.
I went there once and there was like someone, I swear there was like one person whose job it was to fill the water. Someone else like presented us with salt and pepper like as if it was a course.
Yeah.
But the best part, if you go to fancy restaurants like that, is all the little extras they give you between the courses.
Yes.
I don't know what that's called, but that's pretty awesome. There's some egg dish that was
intermezzos.
Like amazing. Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'll
or
trust
an amuse bouche.
Yes.
Yes.
I don't know what that means.
It's a gift to the mouth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so it's like a small, all right, sorry. So you did a stage at Restaurant Eugene.
Uh-huh. And prior to that, I worked for Sean Doty at Sean's. It's in Candler Park, Inman Park area. And after that, went to go work for Linton at Restaurant Eugene's. And I was there for about 3.5 years. At that point in my life, had I been a young kid, I probably would have staged around and pushed myself to work in some other restaurants. But I felt like it was time to go learn from the best. You know, I was trying to really expedite the process of getting to maximum amount of knowledge that I could. So I went to go apply for an externship at the French Laundry.
What's that?
It's probably one of the finest cooking institutions in our country. It's
a restaurant?
It's a restaurant. It's in Yountville, California.
I've never heard of it. So it's like, I mean, I don't go to the best restaurants in the country.
Yeah, it's
I work for nonprofits.
It's a very special place. It's not just the restaurant itself and the institution itself. It's Northern California is, I'd have to say, probably one of the biggest food meccas in the United States.
Right, it's like Eden. There's like everything grows
there. It grows there all
you
the
just
time.
Walk outside, there's like avocados but
that,
and grapes.
That truly is the case. The place I was staying, this lady's house, she would take interns and externs that were working at the French Laundry. And you'd walk out in her backyard, there was like two different kind of persimmon. She had almond trees and it was just like, this is like her daily routine. She'd go out and pick, you know. But the way Napa was created in the wine industry, it was an agricultural community, and they would trade. So back in the 1700s, 1800s, early 1900s, they would trade for their goods. So if you needed milk and you were the guy that had broccoli and cauliflower, you would go trade. And that's how they survived. And for the most part, the wine industry came about because it was such, like you say, like an Eden. But when you go out there to cook, just to see that bounty of incredible goods that are available to you on a daily basis, it really provides an inordinate amount of inspiration.
Great. We're going to need to take our first break. But when we come back, I want to talk with you about how you learned charcuterie. Because
okay.
So far we've talked about how you learned to cook.
Okay.
But I have a sense there's a whole other story about how you learned to prepare meat.
Okay.
Hi, this is your radio friend, Joe Bizard, inviting you to tune into my country music classics here on WREK at 91.1, Friday evenings at 5 o'clock. We come alive at 5 with great old-time music. String bands, bluegrass, old country blues, a little of everything, jug bands, anything that you can imagine, you'll hear on the country music classics. All happy music. A little jug band. Don't forget, this is Friday at 5. We come alive right here with the Country Music Classics on WREK-FM 91.1. Make it a habit. Tune in. Love to have you. That's Fridays at 5 right here on WREK 91.1.
Thanks for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum. Today I'm talking with Kevin Utz, the executive chef owner of Spotted Trotter Charcuterie and Cock and Trice. So before their break, we were talking about how you became a chef, but I'm assuming that becoming a chef isn't the same as becoming a charcuterie.
Charcutier. I would say that through my time at Restaurant Eugene, there was a specific chef that kind of wet my feet in charcuterie, and that was Ryan Smith. He's about to open the Giving Kitchen.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that.
He's an incredible chef. He helped me get excited, and when I went out to go work at the French Laundry, my schedule for the day was to wake up at 3:30 in the morning. Who doesn't? I would get up and roll out to work, and then on my way to work every day, I passed this place called The Fatted Calf, and I was like, that's a charcuterie. And I had heard about him before, and one of the pastry chefs at H&F, Holman & Finch Bakery, his name's Rob Alexander, said that he knew of a charcuterie in Napa that I should go check out. So one and one came together, and I went in one afternoon after my stage, and I asked the owner, Taylor Boedeker, of The Fatted Calf if I could come in and work with him. He said, I'll teach everything I know, just don't open a shop here in Napa. And so I was like, wow, funny you say that. And so we got to working together, and over a period of time, I would spend most of the day at the French Laundry, and then my afternoons and into my evenings would consist of working with Taylor. One day we went to go do a wine dinner at Mondavi's. I got to meet Robert Mondavi's brother, and we were at their home. Big winemaker, Robert Mondavi Wines. And the event was such that we drove out up into the hills. And on the way up there, I asked Taylor how he got started. And he said that he started with the farmers markets. That was his intro into the business. And he was making sausages and salamis, and they would take him to the markets. And it struck me. It was like a pan hitting my head. I was like, oh my gosh, that was right when Linton Hopkins started the Peachtree Road Farmers Market. And so instantly we stopped for gas, and I got on my cell phone and I called my wife. I go, oh my gosh, I figured it out. It was like this giant serendipitous thing that had just happened.
Because you didn't know if you...
Well, I wanted to come back to Atlanta and open a restaurant, but it was 2008 and not a single dime was being lent for anything, much less a restaurant. So I told my wife, I said, we can buy her a stuffer, a linker, and a grinder. And we can get started. And
those are words every wife wants to hear, I'm pretty sure.
It certainly was not something that she knew was coming. And I came back, and we looked for space and went to Sawicki's, is a little sandwich shop in Decatur. Lynn Sawicki, who I owe a debt of gratitude to for allowing me to rent kitchen space. And I went into her shop every day, and it was a 10 by 10 square foot kitchen. And I was doing about 500 pounds of meat a week by myself. And this went on for about 6 months.
And that's because you have to cook in a commercial kitchen to sell at the farmer's
right.
market.
Right. And we got state certified to be a state facility. And that's a whole other ball of wax we can talk about. But the USDA, I was Department of Ag Georgia. So we were consistently looking for our own bricks and mortar building. But when Taylor told me that, it was like gasoline, and it was, you had sparked a match and it had just went off. It was crazy. We came back and got started, and there was no turning back at that point.
So why is it called the Spotted Trotter?
Well, it turns out that a 16-hour drive across the country, it enables you to do a lot of thinking. And so I think I went through probably 100 different names and was writing things down on the drive back. And I don't know what it is called when you have the same, I don't know if it's onomatopoeia, but when you say Spotted Trotter, those two words together, they have a lot of meaning. You know, spots on a pig, spots on an animal. And then a trotter is a pig's foot. So the Spotted Trotter, we came back, and that was it.
So you started working out of a kitchen at a restaurant in Decatur and selling at farmers markets?
Yes.
How long did you do that for?
We were there for a little over a year, 8 months. We started 8 months, and then we began looking for our own bricks and mortar location. And that was the most trying thing in the world, because everyone was coming off that fear of loaning money to anybody. So my wife and I, it took us a long time. I think we went through probably 10 or 12 banks before we finally landed on someone that would bet on us.
And then you opened your first spot in Kirkwood?
We did. We opened our bricks and mortar location in Kirkwood. And then 6 months after that, we expanded that location. We were in Suite A and B, and then realized that production meat cookery shouldn't be done in a strip mall. So it was something that we wanted to get open so badly that we were really taking anything. And we're currently looking for space now to grow the business into a proper manufacturing facility.
With the farmers markets, were you guys popular right off, or was it hard to explain to people what you were doing?
No, I think there's a lot of similarities within, like we talked about before, butchery. And so people think of butchery as bacon, sausage, you know, so you can get the in there. And then once they start to see things like chorizo and salami, it's a 3,000-year-old art form. It's been happening since Caesar roamed the lands. And so there are cultures all across the United States and all across the world that have their own variety of each type of sausage and salami and charcuterie. So there is some semblance of understanding of what it is. It did take a lot of explaining, but it was in a way that was very approachable. We were never trying to shove it down anyone's throat.
You know, I thought I understood meat, and then I looked at your website, and I realized I really don't know much. Because, like, you have a whole page that's just, like, dedicated to salami.
Yes.
Or what's the plural? Salumi?
Salumi.
Salumi?
Yes.
So what makes a salumi or salami a salami?
Salami is going to be ground. Typically, it's going to be ground in some form or fashion.
But so is a sausage.
Sausage, but it's fresh. So salami means it's cured. I mean, it can either be cured or smoked.
Can any sausage become a salami if it's cured or smoked? Are they different?
They're going to be different.
Why?
So,
because you do have smoked sausages, I guess. So, what's the difference between a sausage and a salami?
A salami is always going to be dry cured, or it's going to be fermented. So salami, essentially, the way that you create a salami is by you raise the acidity level, whereby you reduce the pH, and the pH kills the bacteria and makes it edible. So when you think
sounds
about
like science,
there's a lot of chemistry involved in making good salami, and there was a lot of money lost too when we first got started, because there's to look back in the country and say that there's a lot of wonderful regions of our United States that would be ideal for making salami. The wet, humid environment of Georgia is not a great place for making salami.
So how do you do it? Like, leave the science aside. Like, Are you like using salt? Is
it... Lots of salt. Uh-huh.
So it's, you're like taking the meat. First of all, right, walk me through it. So you...
We get the animals or the primal cuts, and then we grind them. And each grind plays an important role, because if you want it to have a big chunky look, you would open
grind
it up.
Less.
Yes. Well, you grind it less, or you grind it in a bigger die.
What's a die?
So the die is the small little pad of holes that the grinder blade goes through.
Okay.
So
how fine you grind
exactly.
It.
Exactly. Okay. And if you want a really nice chunky, you want to be able to see the meats and the garnishment, you would do a bigger grind. And if you want something smaller, emulsified is what bologna would be.
Right, because you can't see like the different cut. Like, I think it's salami, you see like the speckles.
Yes.
Of white.
Exactly. But there's also salami like that that's ground very fine. And then you can get into things like, is it a spreadable salami? You have a very high fat, high acidity level.
Spreadable salami?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that was a thing. All right. So you're grinding it up. Are you adding, is it meat and spices?
So it's meat and salt. Very traditional salumerias will just use salt and meat. Okay. And so they want you just to taste the specifics of what that animal tastes like. And so you think about, it's just salt, meat, and thyme. And the thyme it takes... And you can get very technical now, right? But one thing you can always lean on is, you know, that Mamma Leone in 1782 in Italy didn't really think about the fact that you had to have a specific amount of culture and a specific amount of curing salt. She would just put it up and hang it up, and it was typically because they had to preserve the meat. So you think about the preservation and how this came about. It wasn't because they wanted to do something specific and artistic. It was because they needed to eat.
Right.
They needed to get through the winter months.
Right. They needed the animal to last all year long.
Right.
But you said you went through a lot that went bad. What
exactly.
happens to bad salami?
Well, there's all sorts of factors that can come into play. So you have things like over-drying the casing on the outside, not puncturing enough holes in it so the moisture can leave, putting too much salt or not enough salt. The unfortunate thing is you can't find out until 6 weeks later. And one of the missions of our business is that we only use humanely sourced meat. You will never find any commodity-driven meat at the Spotted Trotter in any way, shape, or form. So everything we use comes from a humanely sourced farm at a baseline. If we can get it locally, it absolutely will. The idea that once it's been ground, you're putting this meat up and you may not know any mistakes you've made for several weeks later. And so that was something that we really didn't think about as a new business. And so we didn't use inexpensive meat. We used the best meat that we could find. So it was a very, very tough road to hoe in the beginning, but we figured it out and things, you know, happen for a reason.
Do you make mistakes anymore?
Oh, yeah. It's part of the best thing about being a chef is that, you know, getting better is only about making mistakes. And I would say 98% of the reason I'm here is because of the mistakes that I've made.
Can any animal be turned into salami?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the weirdest thing you've salamified?
Oh, gosh. We just wrote an article about this, and I'd say we did a part of the one of the fun things that we're trying to do is create heritage of salami and charcuterie in the southeastern United States. So we're developing salamis.
that will be like unique to
unique
the South?
To the South. Okay. So we do at the Cock and Trice. Yeah, at the Cock and Trice, we sell only salamis that we're making for that restaurant. And what they are is new innovative ways to cure. Like we do a salami called a Southern Smashed, and we take peanuts and local cayenne. We get all of our peppers come from local farms, and we dehydrate them, pulverize them into powders. We make a lot of our own pimentons, a lot of our own cayenne, and our chili powders are made locally. And we take the peanuts and lots of local garlic, and we mash that with Atlantic sea salt, and then we hang it up, and it's one of the most unique salamis you ever put in your mouth, and it's delicious. It's one thing to be experimental, but if you don't make it taste good, it's kind of going out the window. One of the most unique things we did, we took an entire midsection of a pig, and we cured it in a Spanish pimenton.
What is that? I don't know.
Pimenton, pimento, essentially.
Pimento, thank you. You say everything Southern for me.
Yeah.
What's the fancy way of saying it?
Pimenton.
Pimenton. I'll sound very cultured.
Spanish pimenton.
Okay.
Once we brined and cured the middle, and then we rolled an entire large diameter Spanish salchichon salami into the center of this animal, tied it up, and we're letting it hang for 2 years.
And you don't know what's going to happen.
No, I have no idea. I mean, we're hoping
like
for the best.
Turducken.
Yeah, we're hoping for the best. But it has to have enough airflow to get through it. And I think if the one mistake we'd probably made in this is not making the belly and the midsection thin enough for the air to get through. So it's a thick piece of meat.
But I looked on your website and there's like all these different types of salami. There's Genoa, Toscano, Lomo, Copa, mm-hmm. Bresaolo. I don't even know what these are.
Brazil.
How did you learn all these?
A lot of research, a lot of just sitting in front of the computer, a lot of just going out and working with some folks. I learned a lot of it from working with Taylor at the Fatted Calf. To be clear, there's a certain amount of tribute that's paid to the people that came before us and the salumeria in Italy and the charcuteries in France. We also do a lot of French salami. We try to find the recipes that have been passed over and over. The great thing about salumi is that for the southeastern United States, there's a lot of ingredients that haven't come into play with making salami. So we're trying to create salamis that are indicative of what you would find in the South. So we did a salami called black pepper sorghum. And what we found is that sorghum by nature has a very good pH for making salami. One of the notes you should always look for when you're eating salami is a good sour. And when you eat this black pepper sorghum, it's got toasted black peppercorns, organic garlic, sea salt, but it also has this sorghum syrup that we put into the salumi. And what it does is it naturally lowers the pH and raises the acidity level. One would think it would be sweet, but it's got a really wonderful, sophisticated sour to it. And we just figure that out just by making it.
You also do a lot of smoked meats?
Yes.
Smoking is you're just like cooking it under a low temperature for a long time.
Yes.
And the smoke cooks it or the smoke just flavors it?
Well, the smoke also kills any bacteria. So I think it's anaerobic. Bacteria has to have oxygen. So what you're doing, I mean, you learn a lot of this through the HACCP plans that you have to write in order to make these meats.
Wait, what are HACCP plans?
HACCP plans are one of the most frustrating things that you have to think about when you're going into meat fabrication. It's becoming more prevalent in restaurants too, because you have to be able to understand the safety and really know why a piece of meat is going to be considered safe. When you're using these cooking practices of curing and smoking and fermenting, there's a certain amount of bacteria that will survive and be ever present. And there also is a certain amount of bad bacteria that could happen as well. So we have to know how we're going to make this lethality occur. And that is just by understanding the HACCP plan. It's a hazard analysis critical control plan. And you have each step to kill bacteria and to make the product safe has its own step. And then it has to have scientific data to prove that the step works.
You were like a telecom major.
Yeah, it was a brutal
no
six
offense,
months.
But...
Right. No, it was a brutal 6 months. And we have 7 HACCP plans at our facility in Kirkwood.
So you have to like create these and give them to like an inspector?
We have an inspector on site every day.
What?
Yeah. The USDA comes and visits our site every day. And anybody that has a meat fabrication or meat production facility in the United States has a USDA inspector on site.
Do you pay for it?
We do if we run overtime, but actually you're paying for it. It's part of your taxes.
Huh.
Yeah, your tax dollars at work.
Are they there like all day or are they just like stop by and say?
They come in and check your records. And in the USDA's eyes, if you didn't write it down, it never happened. So you have to document everything.
It's
so interesting because here we have like an FCC, you know, inspector, and like we're trained the radio station about like if they come, you have to show them this log and like mm-hmm. what to do. But I don't think they ever actually come.
No, they come. They come every day.
So you guys are legit.
Yeah, pretty legit. And HACCP was invented. This is such a funny thing. It was invented in the late 30s so that astronauts could go into space and eat. And it was invented by Pillsbury. And it was a way for each item that was brought into space so they could make sure that the astronauts, once they got up there in that environment, would remain safe. And that was finagled into our entire meat system, and the FDA programmed it into anything that has to be provided and wrapped and sold in commerce has to have a HACCP plan. So cookies, bakery goods, anything.
Never heard of this.
Yeah. It's a fascinating and frustrating thing about working in the food business.
Cool. We need to take another break, but we'll be back with Kevin Utz to talk more about meat and the Spotted Trotter and his new restaurant, the Cock and Trice. You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out while listening to Atmospherics every Monday through Thursday from midnight to 1:30 a.m. on WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Thanks for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum. Today in the studio, I'm talking to Kevin Utz. Kevin is the executive chef, owner of Spotted Trotter, a gourmet charcuterie in Kirkwood and now the Croc Street Market, as well as the new restaurant, the Cock and Trice. So I want to keep talking about meat. Let's get back to smoked meats.
Okay.
You were telling me that the smoke kills the bacteria?
Yeah, so the smoke adds an element of flavor without a doubt, but it also will help kill bacteria through time and temperature. So is once you, there's certain logs and analytical information that talks about the time and temperature of a certain period of how long the meat is cooked will kill the bacteria that is said to live in that environment. So there's all sorts of data logs you have to keep and make sure that you're staying within that time and temperature. And so the smoke will inhibit a certain amount of anaerobic ability for that bacteria to survive. And so the smoke eats up all the oxygen and it will kill the bad bacteria.
And I feel like the smoked meats we're most familiar with are bacon and barbecue.
Yes.
But you don't do barbecue.
No, we don't do barbecue.
Why
we
not?
We do some
the South.
I know.
That's like what we do.
I think barbecue is probably one of the most incredible things that the South has to offer, but I think there are a lot of people doing it. I know how to cook barbecue. I can get down on some barbecue, but I think the place where my heart is trying to do something more with smoke than putting a butt on or a piece of chicken or a really nice brisket. We do a pastrami where we smoke it. You know, we smoke chickens, but to say that there's barbecue, there's a lot of great people in town doing incredible barbecue, so I'd rather not, you know, try to get in that business right now.
So what else are you smoking?
We smoke all of our andouille.
What is that? I know andouille you like get in New Orleans and it's like it's in like Cajun-y kind of stuff. I don't know what makes it different than anything else.
Cajun Creole cooking is I would say next to San Francisco and Northern California, probably one of the most fascinating food cultures in our United States is gonna be that Louisiana cuisine. It's incredible. And I think that what they have to offer from that Spanish and French and that cooking style, and there's so many different spices and cooking techniques that are used in modern day charcuterie. Andouille is an incredible variety of that. And tasso. When I was a young kid, my dad went to New Orleans and he brought back tasso. And it was incredible.
What is it? I don't know what
this
is.
It comes from the butt, the shoulder of the pig.
Wait, the butt is the shoulder?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense.
I know. It doesn't. I don't know.
I clearly know nothing about
meat. Where they got that name from, but the pork butt comes from the really fatty part of the shoulder. It's a really delicious part of the animal. And they take a piece of that and heavily season it and then smoke it for a really long time. It has this really interesting way to season food. So it's used a lot in Creole and Cajun cooking, in etouffees and gumbo. Sometimes it's in gumbo, but primarily it's in a lot of the soups and sauces and things like that you can use it in.
So it's just smoked meat. It's not mixed with other things?
No. Typically it's what we call a whole muscle, but this is a piece of a muscle, really.
Hmm. What makes a kielbasa kielbasa?
Kielbasa is a variety of smoked sausage. It's usually heavily garlic, lots of black pepper, and Polish kielbasa is what you would consider, I would say, as a breakfast sausage in this southern region of the United States. It's like barbecue in the South. Each variety of sausage, depending on what region you live in Poland or what, you know, where that specific sausage is probably probably comes from, that's going to be their way of making it.
So they have debates about who's going to have sausage.
You get in arguments about how much black pepper or how much of each and every ingredient is put into it. Yeah.
All right. And then you guys do a ton of like over 20 different types of fresh sausages.
Yeah. Fresh sausage can get a little crazy because there's so many different varieties. It gets very expensive too. So if you don't find something that's selling and you decide you want to put your heart and energy and lots of money into a specific sausage, and then you realize that no one really knows what linguica is. And so it's a tough sell sometimes.
Yeah, I was going to say, have you had any that just didn't work that no one was buying?
They're all my babies, and I like to think that they all have a place. There are certain things that we'll do smaller weights in. We won't make as much of it just because we know blood sausage is probably one of those. People are really, they either love it or they hate it. There's nobody saying, oh, I'm going to dip my toe in the water to try some, you know, some fresh blood sausage.
I had some of that Abattoir. That was amazing.
Yeah. And that's the great thing about what we're doing is trying to open up people to really great quality ingredients. And it's a really tough sell. If you have a bad experience, it can really harm what's happening in the food scene. So it's better if you're going to get involved in it, try to do it the best you can.
How do you suggest people cook their fresh sausage?
I like to roast it in the oven.
So you're not a griller.
Yeah, grilling is good. But the problem is if you get a hole and it cracks open or any kind of crease in the sausage casing, what then tends to happen is the fat melts down, it renders, and then you got a burn up crispy piece of sausage. And you can do it indirectly. So I say if people are going to cook it on the grill, always have the fire on one side and then the sausage on the other. So it cooks through basically a convection style cooking.
Okay. And so if we're going to roast it...
If you're going to roast it in the oven, you just throw it on a sheet pan, stick it in the oven. I do 350 for about 8 minutes. And the great thing about roasting in the oven is that you're not going to lose a lot of that juice. It stays in the casing, and then you go to bite it, and all that juice is just, it's all up in your mouth.
All right. That's good to know. I always like try to pan, like get a little brown on the outside.
Yeah, browning is good. And then another great way to do it, if you're going to brown it on a pan, stick in a little beer or some wine or something really aromatic that has a lot of good flavor that will pair really well with a sausage. So like if it's a red wine sausage, take a little bit of red wine and find some flavors, put a little garlic in the wine, and then, you know, you can steep the sausage in the wine and then take it out and then brown it. And so then it's fully cooked inside, and really all you're doing is trying to get that Maillard reaction on the outside.
So you're kind of like steaming it?
Steam it, yeah, but steam it in the same flavors that kind of mimic what's in the sausage, and then throw it in the pan, a little butter, and then you can get a nice crispy outside, and that's going to be a good finish.
Nice. Okay, another thing that you guys sell are crepinettes?
Crepinettes, yeah.
What, I've never heard of this before.
So crepinette simply means call fat in French.
And, call fat?
Call fat, yeah. It's the small lining of the stomach and intestine, and it's a beautiful netting, but it's really fatty. So you can wrap it.
It's almost like a spider web of fat.
Yeah, it's really good. It's really, really good. We wrap fish in it at the Cock and Trice. We do all sorts of wonderful preparations. A crepinette simply is, in English, in England, they have faggots, which are basically liver, wrapped in call fat. It's just a really wonderful preparation. It keeps the moisture of the meat inside, and it gets nice and golden brown and crispy. I like to think that it was the first iteration of sausage before they decided to use a casing, but right, I'm not sure if that's true.
Because it kind of looks like the filling is kind of like sausage in that you might be mixing the meat with like vegetables or spices,
yes,
or cheese, and then you wrap it in this. So if I were to get a crepinette, what would I do with it?
I like to toast it in the pan, get a nice saute on it, golden brown, and then once it starts to turn that golden brown color, take the whole pan and pop it in the oven for about 6-8 minutes on 350, depending on the size of the crepinette, and then you've got this wonderful juicy ball of meat surrounded by this nice crispy fat that's on the outside.
And are these like individual servings?
Yeah. So they're about 3 ounces, 3 to 4 ounces a piece, yeah.
So like if you had a date, and you, not you, but if one were to have a date and they wanted to impress them, this could be something you'd want to like
pull out the crepinette.
Okay, and then you have a whole section just called meaty treats, which is just like everything else. I don't know.
Meaty treats, the things like lard. There's all sorts of creative, fun things you can do with cuts of meat that you're not really seeing a lot of anymore. And I think things like scrapple.
Scrapple is very southern, but I don't really know what
it is. It's actually not that
it's
southern.
Not?
It comes from Pennsylvania Dutch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's why you don't see a ton of it here. So scrapple is something where you take some grain, whether it be cornmeal, grits, you're using the collagen and the gelatin to mix with this wonderful grain, and you cook it in a really nice good broth and then let it set, and it'll set hard. And then you take that, slice it, and you can throw it on a grill or just eat it straight.
That's warm like
it
up.
Is it? Yeah. Yeah.
Have you heard of this in Cincinnati?
Mm-mm.
They have this stuff called, oh, I know something meat that you don't know. They have this thing in Cincinnati called geta, and it's like oatmeal and pork, and they mix it together and they make like a loaf.
Like
and
a
you
loaf,
slice
yeah,
it. Yeah,
exactly, yeah. So now you're learning. It's
and
like,
I'm assuming something like that you're poor, you don't have enough money just to eat meat, so you throw in the grains to make it go
yeah,
farther.
But the fascinating thing is now all these things that were once thought of as like, you know, food from slavery days and times when things were really hard and folks were really struggling to survive, but they're taking ingredients that are available now and kind of sensationalizing them, making them really creative ways to make them taste great. And I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. I feel like we're living a really good time for food.
Like, oh, yeah.
Growing up, I just felt like there's a lot of stuff that's just microwaved and boiled. But now, like, food is really good.
Yeah, it is. I landed in a really good time to be working in this industry, and I think there's a lot to be thankful for and be grateful of. And I think we're a 238-year-old nation, and I tell people all the time, it's like, you know, Europe's got 2,000, 3,000 years to get it right. We're just now scratching the surface of what we can do in this country. And I think there's a lot of foraging going on, kind of looking and seeing what's available on the flora of the forests and things around us and saying, let's cook with that. Let's find some ingredients that are really unique and push the envelope on that and try to see what else we can come and celebrate more of. It's the time for it, you know?
Nice. Do you guys sell some of your meat to other restaurants in Atlanta?
A lot of restaurants.
So where can folks taste Spotted Trotter meat? Give us a little sampling.
Okay, we sell to...
But don't leave anyone out, because they're going to be really mad at you. No pressure.
We sell to about 140 restaurants in the Southeast. Yeah, that's what enabling a USDA certification allows us.
That's a lot of meat.
Yeah, we sell to Ritz-Carlton. We sell to the Grand Hyatt. We sell to the W Hotel.
I thought you were like going to be on an airline.
We sell to Delta Airlines. We sell to Linton Hopkins.
Fancy Delta.
Yeah. It's all the first class flights going to Paris, Brussels. I don't have the list in front of me, but it's through Eugene Kitchen, Restaurant Eugene. Linton Hopkins was given the task of coordinating all the menus for Delta.
Must be nice in first class.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know.
But they're adding 4 more flights, so we'll be on 8 flights in first class to Europe this coming summer. In addition to that, we do sell to about 140 different restaurants and growing in the Southeast, and we're trying to shrink the menu down a little bit so that we can really understand what this business is all about and make sure that we're making the best, not try to make the most.
Wow.
Thank you.
Oh, my God, I didn't record it. All right. Well, we need to take another break, and then we'll be back to talk a little bit more with Kevin Utz and learn about his new restaurant, The Cock and Trice.
The music is different here. The vibrations are different. Not like planet Earth. Another place in the universe, up under different stars. That would be where the altered destiny would come in. Equation-wise, the first thing to do is to consider time as officially ended.
Tune in Saturdays at 8 p.m. for Coffee and Sushi, playing the best in atmospheric, chilla electronic music. Saturdays at 8 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta.
You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm your host, Amanda Plum. Today I've been talking with Kevin Utz. Kevin is the guy behind the Spotted Trotter charcuterie, as well as the Cock and Trice. So let's talk about your new restaurant. You just opened one this year?
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. We opened in January.
So tell me about first of all, a friend was trying to explain to me what a Cock and Trice is, and it sounds disgusting, but I'd like you to explain this concept to me.
It's a medieval cooking preparation where they would take a capon chicken and sew it to a suckling pig and stuff it.
I heard they took like the head of one.
Yeah. And so the idea for me and
No, I want to know. No, tell me what this thing is.
Okay,
I want to understand.
So it's really an innovative way to present food in the Tudor time period. I mean, you have to think, these chefs that were working in this time period were probably at their wit's end. They're like, oh, the kings and queens want something incredible. What the hell are we going to make? We've made everything possible. This is during Escoffier's time period, and you know, you reach a certain point where, oh, we can't get high gluten cornstarch, or we can't, there's nothing else we can do. So let's put these animals and sew them together.
And so it was like a hybrid, like it was like...
Yeah, so they would take a capon chicken, which is a castrated male chicken, and they would take it and they would let it grow and get a little bit, it's a little bit more tough. So they would take that chicken and then they would sew it to a suckling pig.
How do you mean they sewed it to it?
They would literally stitch it together.
But like what parts are they stitching together?
They would take the head and part of the pig, and they would take the lower half of the capon chicken. And or vice versa. Sometimes they would take a giant codfish and they would put it in the middle of that. But
it was like the original turducken.
Yeah. The tricky thing, though, is you have to find proteins that have the same density and water content so that they cook at the
same
same amount of time. Because you don't want a dry head and a lower extremity that's really moist.
As the owner of three chickens, you are never going to be invited to my house. That's all I'm saying. All right. So why did you pick this as the name of your restaurant?
That's a great question. I think the Cock and Trice exemplifies what we want to do in food and meat preparation. We want to put unique cooking preparations on the plate. We want people to come and be excited about charcuterie. We want to push the envelope a little bit. So we do a little bit of molecular gastronomy, but we also pay tribute to a lot of old world cooking techniques and meat. You know, when you go into any restaurant, and it's even the case when you're doing your food cost. In any restaurant in the United States, what is the most fundamental thing? It's the center of the plate item. So it's the meat. It's the meat that's celebrated. We've spent a lot of time over the past, you know, 3 to 5 years celebrating the produce and what's happening there. And what's fundamentally changing in this business of the USDA and the meat is that we're getting excited about what it takes and the meat on the plate. So like you have this great pasture, you know, grass-fed steak or whatever it might be. But no one's paying attention to what it takes to get that product there because it's dirty and ugly. No one's thinking about the processing piece, right? And if we don't, and if people aren't celebrating that and putting that on a pedestal, we're going to lose everything that we've worked for to put good food back on the plate of a lot of people.
Well, I have to say, I used to work at a restaurant years ago. I won't say which one, but like all the food came from Sysco.
Yeah.
And it was like already done. Like, right. You know, no one was making ketchup. You just got ketchup, you
right.
know, or... I don't know, like you, there's no way of knowing where the meat came from,
right.
For sure.
Right.
And like you'd get French fries that are already cut and frozen. And I think, you know, what you do and what a lot of chefs are doing now is doing everything in house.
Yes.
And knowing where the meat came from and, you know, not just buying bologna, but you're making bologna.
Right.
That's a big difference.
It's crucial. And I think we like to think that people taste it in the food. And I think you can attest to this. You can go to a restaurant and you can sit down and look at their menu and go, these people are buying all processed ingredients. If you go to a menu and it's smaller, it's because the labor it takes to put into that menu is probably going to be more than they can afford to price it out at. So it's just really important for folks to understand if you're going to a restaurant like that, you know, understand that the reason it's expensive is because it takes a lot of time and energy to make that food. There are enough places out there that you can buy cheap food from, but just know that it's you know, it's not coming from a place of the heart. It's coming from the place of the wallet. And, you know, I think we think about that more than anything. I have a prep crew that comes in at 7 in the morning, every morning, to make the menu that we have to produce. And we work until 5:30 that night to produce that day's menu. And it's a lot of pride, a lot of passion. And
right, because you only do dinner service.
Yes.
So, but you have people there at 7 in the morning?
7 in the morning, yeah. We start up.
Wow.
That's what it takes. And as we get stronger and better, you know, we hope to do more and have lunch and do some fun brunch stuff in the future. But right now it's getting a handle on, you know, we're 2 months old. So the restaurant is truly about being as innovative as we can and trying to really showcase the service and the service industry as a whole and making sure that you come in and not just eat. We want you to have an experience. We want you to walk away saying, wow, that was an experience for me.
Yeah, your mission on your menu, it says your mission is to pay tribute to the farmers, the service industry, and their families, and our ever-engaged and fiercely supportive food community. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think we can all look around and know that there's not a lot of pride in people telling you that they're a server or a host or a dishwasher. But all these people fundamentally make the food that you eat at any restaurant happen. And if people aren't celebrating what they're doing, the whole idea of coming to a good restaurant is going to go by the wayside. These people create and they survive on the work that they put in, and it's often forgot. it's important that we understand as a community and as restaurateurs to try to celebrate them more, right? And we want them to be understood as helping you have that good experience. We want them to be celebrated more. And I think it's important that, you know, a lot of the people in the service industry should have a feeling of pride when they walk away and they say, well, what do you do for a living? And you say, I'm a server at you know, the Cock and Trice. This is what I do. And in Europe, it's been happening for the past 100 years or longer. They make careers out of it. And that should be something that people should be excited about and be proud of where they are.
So how do you do that at your restaurant?
We try to do it in the best way that we can with regards to give benefits. We offer benefits to all of our employees. We make sure that they walk away with a good rate of pay. We want to make sure that they can have a good quality of life. We work to get all the guys that are working on the line and are working to cook. We give them a four-day on, 3-day off schedule. What's that?
Why that?
Because it's a lot of hard work. Working on the line is something that you really don't understand what it does to your body, and it you're standing on your feet for 10 hours, a lot of times bent over, a lot of times getting burned, a lot of times it's tough work. And so, you know, in order to rebuild and to have some energy and be proud and excited when you come to work and have a clear head, you know, you usually spend the first day sleeping on your day off. And then, you know, if you've got things you've got to tend to your family, your friends, you've got to go take your dry cleaning or go pick up your groceries, you really don't have time to do that. And so we want people to come in and be excited about it. And so that's something that we're trying to help change and really showcase the people that are providing great cheese, the people that are putting the wine program together, the folks that are working the bar. All of those people should be celebrated. It's not just the job I'm doing. It's if it wasn't for those folks, these chefs that are being touted as like celebrity or given so much attention to, like, we need to start putting them on the plate and saying, let's get them excited. Let's make them a part of what is happening in the business.
That's really awesome. Tell me a little bit about the menu for the Cock and Trice.
So the menu is broken down into the cold preparations in salumi and whole muscle, which we didn't really talk about that, but that's items like lomo and lonzino. We take the whole piece of the loin muscle, and then that's cured and fermented, and then it's air dried for up to 3 months. And so those items are sliced razor thin, and all of the left side of the menu in the column is all charcuterie that we're producing solely for the Cock and Trice. And then there's a preparation of cooked charcuterie, prepared charcuterie, which is, to the best of my knowledge, not really happening anywhere in any menus, is where we take charcuterie like spreadable salami or tasso, and we make something out of it and put it in a dish. So huh. It's part of like a cooked it's part of like a cooked preparation of salumi or charcuterie, and then
give me an example of what that would look like.
So we do an item. It's called a second stanza, where we take we have a second stanza spreadable salami that is solely comes from the spotted trotter. No one else that I know makes it. It's a very herbaceous, rich salami that's spread. Well, we take that and we roll it into a torchon, and we
A torchon?
It's when you put it into a plastic wrap and then kind of torque it and make it into like a log, say. So it looks like a.
Do you have like dictionaries at your restaurant? Because I'm not sure I'm going to be able to order.
Once that torchon is done, we slice it razor thin, and then we deep fry it in a little bit of breading, and then we take that and finish it with a quail egg on top. And it's got some beet puree and a corn genoise, which is like a corn cake. And so they break the egg open, and it kind of spills into this wonderful herbaceous salami, and they eat it up. It's a really good preparation. And then we have a section where we celebrate cheeses. We have a cheesemonger that works at the Spotted Trotter. His name's Scott Stroud. He's been with us for 4 years, and he really does a great job, an amazing job, and he'll talk to you about cheese till he turns purple. He'd be someone good to have on the show.
I would love to.
Yeah, but he's a thrill a minute, and he puts together a really great cheese program and works with us to get some really great cheeses that are celebrating dairies that are in the Southeast. So we try to get cheesemakers that are really doing some wonderful work in cheese in the Southeastern United States. We have showcased those on the menu as well. And then we get into the entrees. And the entrees
We haven't even gotten to the entrees yet.
No, not yet. We showcase the different cuts of meat in new innovative ways. We have an item called beef pillows, where we take a little bit of oxtail and some beef cheek. We use a little molecular gastronomy to set it up. And once it's set, we cook it in an oven so it forms a shape. And then we rest it on, it's basically like a sunchoke whip It's a Jerusalem artichoke whip, and then we finish it with a fluid gel of carrot and then some rainbow Swiss chard. So it's a really nice dish. But the entrees are really celebrating unique cooking techniques with meat.
Yeah. And you do have some vegetables.
We do, in fact.
I had a friend that went there recently. He went on a double date, and he's like, we didn't order enough vegetables. Like, they're like, they said they had a lot of meat.
I was asked what's the most popular seller there, and ironically, it was our vegetable plate. But what we do is we take all the vegetables that are on the whole menu, and we do a different cooking preparation than is actually on the menu. So we have about anywhere from 6 to 12 different vegetables on one plate.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and they're all done in different cooking preparations. And so that's a really neat dish, and it kind of pushes the chefs to do something unique and different, and it gives them the opportunity to be creative. So that's a really neat thing.
Do you have meat desserts?
Actually, right now, we do have a meat cocktail. We have a cocktail that's got a little spear of cured meat, and we've got one that's got some bacon in it. And the cocktail itself, it doesn't have meat in it, but it's garnished with meat. It's a delicious cocktail. And then we have a dessert right now. It's a chocolate salami. It's not got meat in it, but it's made to look like salami. It's come from Cacao, a chocolate shop here in Atlanta. And she does it with it's a really creamy texture, and it's got amaretto cookie inside of it. It's a really beautiful old world. It's actually done in Italy, and she makes it. And we have it on the menu right now.
And do you actually cook at the Cock and Trice?
Yes.
How often are you cooking there?
Every night.
Been
there. I work every night, yeah. We cook, and I cook when everything that I try to put my hands on, I can. And the idea is that I try to instill confidence and creative inspiration into all the guys that are cooking with me as well. And there are certain things that I just can't let go of yet. We're only 2 months old, so I should be expected to try to do as much as I can.
And I know you guys are only 2 months old, but do you know what's next for you?
I could get myself into a lot of trouble if I...
With whom?
With my wife.
Okay. So go on, tell me.
We're gonna push to try to get a new facility open for the Spotted Trotter, but since we've opened, we've been growing. So it's time to kind of let's see what we can do to let this year kind of recoup. Every time we look at the bottom line of the profits that should be coming in, it's being spent for infrastructure into the business. So we're ready to do some really great things with the restaurant this year, and just kind of hold off on growth for a little while and make sure that we can, you know, pay for the things that we've built and make sure that we can start planning for the next step in 2016.
Will we see the Spotted Trotter at some farmers markets this season?
Absolutely. We'll be at the Peachtree Road Farmers Market, and then we also do the Grant Park Market, which are two of my favorite markets. There's also the market that happens at the Carter Center. We've been asked to do a pop-up there, and we'll see if we can make that happen as well.
All right. So if folks are interested in trying some of your meat, there's the farmers markets, there's the Kirkwood location for Spotted Trotter, the Crog Street Market, Spotted Trotter, and the Cock and Trice at Crog Street Market.
Yes, you've got it. Yep.
And a description of all your meats is available on your website, which is?
thespottedtrotter.com.
All right. There's one last question that I ask all my guests. It's a question that my brother-in-law, Kevin Hernandez, suggested over Thanksgiving dinner. He thinks there's two types of people in this world, whack-a-mole people and skee-ball people. Which are you and why?
So, let's see. I would say skee-ball.
Why?
It takes a little bit of skill.
It takes
a little bit of skill, and you can watch and learn, and the mistakes you make, you can correct the next time you throw the ball. Whereas whack-a-mole, once you hit it, you're not going to know what's coming next.
Yeah, I can see. It seems like preparing meat, charcuterie, is a skee-ball sort of thing.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Amanda.
I can't wait to check out your new restaurant.
Please come. Come eat some vegetables and meat.
I will. And thank you for listening to the North Avenue Lounge. We're here every Monday at noon. You can listen to this and past episodes on our website, www.northavenuelounge.com. Have a great week. Thank you.
Thank you.